Hi, I'm Bob Bezanz. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and the power of the AA program, I haven't had a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. And one of the reasons I think Pat was interested, Pat got sober early in 68 and came in 66 or 67, one of those two. And I think one of the things that's fun is as you get older, it's nice to have people you identify with. You know, you hear a story, you know, but if you have to be careful, you listen to my tape three times in a row, you have a relapse. So you have to kind of throw one at Tom or David or one of those. I'm looking forward to this weekend. It's interesting, the three of us have almost 100 years between Ivester and Aronofsky. David Aronofsky got sober in April 20th, 1967, and I got sober December 10th. So David and I have been, and Gracie and our wives have been great friends since we've been sober and shared a lot. David was instrumental in helping me get one of the first AA talks I ever gave out of town was at the 24-hour club that David had me replace him at. We've shared a lot over the years, and Tom is one of my heroes. I have a number of heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. A disgustingly large number of them are dying, and I still have a few that I admire so much, and Tom is one of those that I hold in the highest esteem. It is one of the creepy things when you go to a conference. Tom said he was at a conference just recently, and he was the youngest in years and the youngest in sobriety at 40 years of the guys and gals in the program. That doesn't happen very often. Increasingly, you go to a conference, and if you're around 30 years, you can end up having almost as much sobriety as anybody in the room. And as you know, everybody wants to hang out with the big kids. You know, I mean, one of the things that attracted me to service and attracted me to conferences is these people who had 20, you know, who had 15 and 20 years more sobriety than I had. And so I don't like the idea that the big kids are moving on. I want the men and women who are ahead of me that are active and have a vitality in their program. One of the most exciting things about Ivester is his spirit. And I think this program is so exciting and so wonderful. Not only does it literally give you the opportunity to raise the dead, you know, as we, those of us who have recovered know. I mean, you know, and allow us to stop doing the damage to ourselves and to all the people around us, which in itself would be enough. But it also has the opportunity to add a quality to our lives that for most of us we would have never have had. We just, you know, had we never had the disease of alcoholism, a lot of us just would have been very ordinary, you know, people. And I think my need because of my disease and my need because of my zest in Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to develop in ways that I don't, you know, I've had to develop in certain ways that I never would have had I not had the disease. So it's, and the privilege of being able to be part of this fellowship. Now, after I've talked about how much I like fellowship, I want to tell you that I'm leaving tomorrow morning. And that is not what I've been taught. I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous to show up for a conference and attend the whole damn thing. But about 3 months after you invited me, a year and a half ahead of time, I got an invitation to go to Mexico for a week with my wife, paid, at an AA conference. And then I started thinking. And it was, they're leaving tomorrow. So I said, I don't know if I can do that. Let me call the conference. So I called Tom Carefer, I think his name was, and I, or Carefree or something like that. And I asked if they'd cooperate, and you were very nice, and you cooperated so I could get to talk Friday night and go do that. So there's a lot of people in this room, a few people I sponsor and a lot of people I know, and so this is kind of like being home. That's really nice for me. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school. I was a little over 5 feet tall. When I entered high school, I was 4'11". Insecure, big mouth, always trying to compensate, you know, trying to be part of the in-group, you know, never quite making it, you know, wanted to be a jock, but I had a back problem. I had a yellow streak down the back of it. And always wanted to, you know, have the result without the process, you know. But I was always a kid who tried to, you know, act out and get people to notice me by acting out and by my big mouth. I always felt like everybody else got to school an hour early, held a meeting, and decided what to do for the day, and I missed the meeting. I mean, that's how I always felt. I'd kind of say, hell of a meeting, you know, hoping you'd talk about the meeting so I'd know what went on, but no one ever did. And That's okay, Tom. I went to a buddy of mine stole a fifth from his dad's liquor cabinet. We went out and we split that fifth. And I can remember that night. It was just a wonderful night. It was like my life changed. It was, you know, all of a sudden I went to a military school and, you know, the freshmen didn't or couldn't hang out with seniors. I mean, that was kind of, you know, you'd end up with a closet full of shoes to shine or, about age Sam Brown's, you'd have to, there was a lot of hazing and a lot of, you know, structure. You know, you put a few drinks, you know, that night they put a few drinks in me and I went to a party where there were mostly seniors at. And I thought I fit in just fine. I'm sure they didn't think I fit in. Later that evening, I got sick and all that kind of stuff. But my sister was a junior, and these guys were at a party. And it just changed my life. It was like I found the secret. From that moment on, I became a social drinker. Anytime anybody else said, I'll have a drink, I said, so shall I. I just never passed up an opportunity to do it after that. I went to a military high school on a college campus, and we drank in high school. We had fraternities. We drank in high school like most colleges drink. We drank a lot. I never realized, I think the Catholics drink more than anybody else. I don't know if not anybody else, but we drink more than some folks. I know that. Of my high school class of 120, we have 12 members of AA that I'm aware of. Of my five closest friends, four of us are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. My college roommate's in Al-Anon. You know, we all have about 20 years plus of sobriety. We did a lot of drinking. A couple of us almost died of alcohol poisoning in high school. We did a lot of drinking. By the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was a loud conversation. I'd been in a couple, you know, car accidents and false IDs and all the sorts of trouble you get into, and I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought that, you know, the timing was off, or, you know, when you're underage, you know, you're just forbade to drink. Doesn't matter if the cops catch you if you have one or two or 14 or my... Didn't matter if my father caught me, if I had one or two or 14. I was in trouble. So I thought most of my problem was that I was an underage drinker, and if I got to be treated like an adult, get the hell out of this authority structure. And I went away to school, and I thought my drinking normalized. My drinking normalized, hell, it got worse. I got away from whatever structure was holding me back, and I became even more of a problem. And I went to the University of Notre Dame, as Pat talked about, and I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I didn't finish, one of my great claims or, you know, things I'm not very proud of. It's funny, I went back. AA will allow you to revisit your sins. And I was asked to go back and give an AA talk about 12 or 15 years ago. And I've been back twice to the University of Notre Dame and gave an AA. But the first time I went back, I hadn't been back since I left. And it was and Milos agreed to go with me. He said, well, I want to go with you. I had an amend I wanted to make, and I thought it was a real big amend. When I finally made it to the priest, he didn't remember who I was. You know, one of those things, you know, where you know, that we think is a big deal, you know, and it isn't a big deal at all. And I'm down there in the middle of my talk, talking to a couple of thousand people. It was really kind of an emotional, you know, revisiting the memories, you know, because, you know, when you ask drunks ordinary questions, like, where did you go to school? And there's this pause. It isn't like I don't know where I went to school. Now, do you tell them the one you graduated from, or the one you attended the longest, or the one you're going to go back to? You know, you ask a drunk if they're married. I mean, they get this kind of confused look on their face, you know, and they don't... And it is, we just don't know how much time you have. You know, do you work? You know, I mean, you think, you know... Do you have any children? I mean, these are not, you know, I mean, it's kind of a complex, you know, sort of deal. And so, it's silly. I mean, people would ask me where I went to school. They don't care. It's a social question. But for us, you know, it's a complicated question. And I'm in the middle of my talk, and I said, I've always felt a deep sense of failure about this place. And I said, I think I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. I always thought there'd be a deeper answer to that question, but I'm not sure that there... And when I left Notre Dame, I was due to be commissioned as an officer in the Army, and I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. We badmouthed a lot of psychiatrists. I was diagnosed by a psychiatrist. His recommendation to me was that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there wasn't anything wrong with that diagnosis. Wasn't anything wrong with the prescription. I thought he was nuts, but it got me out of school. Came back, finished school at St. Thomas University. When I finished school, my father asked me to leave home. I'm one of seven kids, great mother and father, wonderful brothers and sisters. He just said, you're a pain in the ass. He said, you don't follow the rules, you're always in trouble. He said, I can't keep you around any longer now that you got your degree, you know, out. And I'm with my degree and my freedom. I went on and took a job as a carryout boy in a liquor store. And I've had the gift of discernment as long as I can remember. I almost killed a little girl. She was not hurt, but I came within inches. I backed the delivery truck drunk one morning over her and her bicycle. Lost that job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck, got arrested. Took a job as a waiter. I'm working as a waiter at a Minneapolis athletic club, one of the few member waiters they've ever had. I've got an apartment in St. Paul, but in the 6 months I worked as a waiter, I think I made it home about 10 nights. I'm, you know, drinking, I don't know, a fifth, a quarter a day. You know, I'm going to work. I take a couple of beers. You know, I'm sleeping around with the waitresses and waiters. I got no place. I'm keeping my clothes in a couple of paper bags, and I get up in the morning, drink three or four beers, go to work, work from 10 to 2, and at 2, I go to a bar and drink beer, and 2 to 5, and at 5, I go buy a pint or a half pint or a fifth and keep it in my locker and pour it into a bottle, and I'm just a bum, you know, just a, you know, ashamed of myself, don't like who I am, don't like what I'm doing, my family, I don't have any contact with the guys, I'm ashamed of myself, I just don't want to be around anybody, I'm just, you know, every once in a while you walk by a mirror and you take a look at it and you think, how in the hell did I end up, you know, this is just temporary, it's all I'm going to do, I mean, this is just, I don't know how I got here, but, you know, pretty soon I'm going to, you know, blow out of this place, and I don't know, went to a party one night, got my face kicked in, got fired as a waiter, had no place to go, and I went to my parents, I said, can I come home? And, you know, they didn't like that very well. And they said, yeah, you can come home if you don't drink. And I promised I wouldn't drink. I didn't keep the promise, you know. So now I'm taking the hinges off the liquor cabinet at midnight, you know, and stealing bottles from my old man. A lot of drinking. Those guys, I mean, those Second World War veterans were my heroes. Those were the guys who made life look easy. They came home after the war and married and had large families and, you know, started businesses and were active in the community. They played hard. They worked hard. And I just thought if you just kind of survived till you were 40, that's what you turned out to be. You just got to be a vice president. It's just kind of a matter of matriculation. And, you know, I wasn't matriculating as well as I thought. And so when I moved back in the house, I really wanted to change my life. I was about as displeased with myself as I'd ever been, disgusted with myself. If you're a drunk, you know, you're always starting over. You know, you don't always finish. We don't finish very well, but we start over a lot. I wanted for me what my family wanted for me. You know, and then you could not have convinced my father, I don't think, that I wanted for me what he wanted for me. I mean, it looked like I was hell-bent to tear my life apart and to trash most of the values that my family stood for. But when I moved back in the house, I really tried to put my act together. I got engaged to the woman I'm now married to. I went with her for 2 or 3 years, and then we broke up. For a couple of years, we broke up for almost an entire year during the worst year of my drinking. Then we got back together and became engaged. Today, she is my very lovely wife, and tomorrow we're going to Mexico. She's a 30-year member, or almost a 30-year member. In 2 months, she'll be a 30-year member of Al-Anon. She's very active, sponsors, help starts groups, and a neat lady. We wouldn't be married today, I don't believe, if it wasn't for Eleanor. My story is kind of crappy. I had problems in sobriety, and I mean, that's tragic. I think that most people don't. They just get sober and everything's just fine. You know, just, you know. And that's, as near as I can tell, that seems to be. But mine's kind of a tacky story. Even in sobriety, I had difficulty. If Linda and I each didn't have a program, I think we would have killed each other. I mean, I think we would have. But because we each had a program, when difficulties came up, more often than not, we looked at our part in the issue. And sometimes, I'm such a big horse's ass, you almost couldn't find Linda's part. But she would grab a hold of something to look at it. I mean, I think we would have, I just think we would have torn ourselves apart. The beauty of each of us having a program and being able to share what we do has been a marvelous thing for us, and I treasure that. And so I moved back in the house, got a job as an executive trainee, bought my first car, and I'm on the road, you know. Only I can't shut it off. I don't know what the hell's wrong with me. I couldn't shut it off when I went to school. Now I'm working at a company. Now I was the class drunk at Notre Dame. I had three guys petition to have me removed from the civil engineering class. I mean, I really was. They studied in my room. I was never in the room. I was the class drunk. Now I'm a company drunk. I mean, I'm in a company of engineers, and I'm just, you know, I'm hungover. I use up my sick leave the first couple of months. I'm late. I'm just, you know, I mean, I'm in trouble from the get-go. I just, you know, I quit that job after 6 months. I take a sales job because I need more freedom. I got this sales job, and now I'm, you know, about, you know, 2 or 3 months into the sales job, and I go on about a 3 or 4 day. One of my buddies got married. Weddings were always bad. You know, how you, when one of your friends gets married, it's just, you know, it was kind of like a license, you know. And I woke up one Thursday afternoon in July of 1967, and I hadn't been to work for 3 or 4 days. And I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live, and I'm just in a panic. You know, just I'd been in a blackout the night before. I kind of remember that I got into kind of a fight with one of my good friends, and I'm, you know. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so dumb when I called AA. And I got an old-timer on the phone who talked to me for a few minutes and then made a call on another line and came back and said, could you meet a couple of guys at a cafe in about an hour? And I said, yeah, I could. He named a cafe pretty close to where I grew up. And as soon as I got off the line, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to go meet these two guys. I just, you know, I called work and found out I still had a job, and called Linda and found out I was still engaged, and called home and found out they'd still allow me to live. You know, and I thought, why the hell did you call AA? You know, I mean, this is kind of an overreaction. You're just feeling guilty. And so here's where delusion entered in. I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. You know, I mean, honest to God, I had a curiosity. Maybe if I went and saw what these guys looked like, I'd know better why I wasn't an alcoholic. And I went to a meeting. When you're young and in trouble, you get waltzed in front of a lot of folks to try to help you, doctors and psychiatrists and deans and bishops and priests and judges and attorneys and stuff. And I'd been, throughout my young career, I'd been waltzed in front of a lot of people who would try to tell the family what to do with you. And I thought, once again, I'd be waltzed in front of a couple of people who would ask me a bunch of questions and then recommend what I do. And, of course, that didn't happen to me. I met two men, one with 6 months, one with 5 or 6 years, who sat me down in a booth and said, we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous. One guy was named Warren, not the same Warren as my sponsor, a different Warren. And he had 6 months, and the other man was Bob, and he had 6 years. And they said, we're members of AA. And they said, we drank and had a lot of problems drinking. We found a solution for our drinking, and we don't know if that fits your situation. We'd like to tell you a little bit about ourselves. And when we're done, you know, I mean, there was just no business. They weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. It was just, and they sat me down in that booth and told me their drinking stories and told me about their entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous and gave me a sense about what they were doing today. And my life changed in that moment. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're getting kind of some of the patterns I see in AA I find a little troubling. One of the traditions I hope we never lose is the tradition of sharing our experience, strength, and hope rather than our thinking. When you share your life with another human being, something happens. Those men changed my life that day. I went back to drinking briefly twice after that, but the impact of that meeting was never to leave. And they asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting, and I went to a meeting. I drank once after a month on a business trip to the West Coast and a training session, and I didn't call AA like I was advised. I told the men and women in my group that I had made a $100 bet and I wasn't drinking, which kept me sober one of the 2 weeks I was in California. And then I got sober again, and I was sober almost 3 months when I got married. We went on our honeymoon, and I drank on our honeymoon. And I'm such a sneaky little craphead. I think underneath I kind of, you know, had that idea all the way through. But I'm also a complier, you know, so I'm on the surface, I'm complying. We honeymooned in Acapulco, and you know where the divers dive off those cliffs? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And I went over Now, this is not graceful. Don't picture graceful. Picture the ugly American. Picture the guy in the movie who you don't, you know, picture the guy who's had 9 planters punches, you know, and I go over and I introduce myself to the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate my sophomore or junior year at Notre Dame. He was not impressed. His bodyguards were not impressed. I am just loaded. So I go down, I say to Linda, I'm going to try that. She said, you are not trying that. So I go down and I dive off the public landing, climb up the cliff, I split my swimsuit, I cut my leg, I'm up about 85 feet and I'm stuck. I can't get up, I can't get down. Linda is going absolutely nuts. I mean, she, you know, I mean, nuts. This, we're married, you know, 4 days. And this ass is up there, you know. And you got the picture, right? And, you know, and so I didn't know what to do. So I'm trying to figure out whether to dive or jump. I'm looking down, waiting for the waves to come in. You know, there's not quite enough water all the time, so you got to have a wave in. You know, that's not as tough as it sounds. But so if I'm trying to figure out, the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks till I made it. If I would have jumped, I would have died. Norm Alpe talks about seconds and inches, you know, because you got to get out about 30 feet to go hit the middle. I didn't know that. I just kind of eyeballed it. You know, I'm just, you know. On our 10th anniversary, we're down there in Mexico, and we're at midnight. We're just kind of watching the divers. They dive with torches at night. And I said to Linda, we're down there, and she gave me a little picture of the cove and said, there but for the grace of God. And I said, God, honey, that's the dumbest thing I ever did. And she said, Bob, it's not even in the top 10. So I don't know how two people can share a life and have such a different view of the life of the parent. I don't. But she's getting tougher. I gained a little weight, and I'm a little out of shape, but I told her, she's been after me, you know, to get exercising. So I said, you know, maybe I'll buy a bike. She said, that wouldn't be a bad idea. So I bought the bike. Now she's mad at me. I bought a Harley. And so even when I please her, I mean, even when it's my attempt to do what she would like me to do, I don't know whether there's a gap, you know? I don't know how that is. She doesn't like that story. She does not think it's funny. I've taken her to 2 piercing shops and a tattoo parlor, and she has not yet joined in this activity. And But now I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous is like coming home. I grew up in a heavy Catholic tradition. I've been interested in spirituality and religion and philosophy since I've been knee-high to a grasshopper, and it was painful for me to be such an ass. I did not like who I was. I did not like how I behaved. I did not like anything about it. I wanted, I think, to be like my father. I wanted to be a good man. And I wasn't a good man, and I had a gift for being an ass, which is a bad combination. You know, just never had to learn how to be an ass. It was kind of like riding a bicycle. Just kind of, you know, still, once in a while, just have this flair, you know, just, it's a gift. And being in AA was like coming home. It was like finding out that you know, what was wrong with you. Like coming to a whole group of people who had your experience. And, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, AA, you could walk into AA and tell someone you parked the car in the living room and no one ever asked you why. I mean, that was one of the most amazing things to me. You could say almost anything and no one, I mean, all the normies in the world would always ask you why. Why did you do that, Bob? And an alcoholic knows better than to ask why. It doesn't matter why, and they know at some level we don't know why, and it just, I mean, it is, and that we all have done things like that, you know, and so all, I mean, it was just wonderful. I mean, it was just like being bathed in a warm pool. I still obviously had resistance. I drank twice after coming in, but I basically liked AA, liked everything about it, and that was a gift. The 2 reasons I think I'm sober today is it hasn't been difficult for me to like AA. And I like old timers. I've always liked teachers. And the other thing is I can't keep my mouth shut. And on a personal level, I have probably been communicated late, and maybe only partially, what's going on in my life, which has also saved my life. I didn't keep as many secrets. I massaged them a little bit when I talked to my sponsor, because you don't want sponsors to know everything. And it just And I really didn't intentionally massage her, but it's just the way I was. So now I'm 24 years old, I'm sober, and I think, hey, this is wonderful. I had a lot of potential. I don't know if you know that or you can kind of tell from my story. I was just chock full of potential. They gave me this impression that I was holding back in life, that I probably had the ability to be a Rhodes Scholar, an Olympic athlete, and I'd just been holding back, and that any moment I was probably going to bring this to bear and life was going to be okay. And now I thought I'm poised in life, you know, that now I'm sober, I know what's wrong. So now that I'm in an organization that helps me know what's wrong and has got an answer for what is wrong, I had to really be able to start changing the direction of my life and start actualizing all this potential. I mean, that's not a joke. That's literally what I expected to have happen. Well, that didn't start to happen to me. It seemed to me, I'm going to talk a little bit about problems in sobriety, and I don't want to give the impression that my early sobriety was anything but wonderful. My early sobriety was an adventure, it was joyful, it was fun, it was all sorts of things, but I also had problems. I had issues. I had about five or six little problems. One of my little problems is I couldn't get up in the morning. Now, it was just, it has something to do with when I went to bed, but I didn't identify that. I didn't kind of get the connection until I was well into sobriety. So I'm supposed to be at work at 8, and I'd get up about 7:45. And it's kind of hard to be at work at 8 if you get up, not for an alcoholic, but it's hard on you. You know, I mean, just, you know, work quick, you know, so it would work. I had a little financial problem. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made. And if you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're trying that out. And then Linda and I started to have kids and had a few marital issues, and Linda had a wonderful father, Notre Dame graduate, came home every night at 5:00. That was not my style. We saw more of each other when we were dating than when we, you know, all of a sudden I'm going to, you know, 4 or 5 meetings at night and 2 or 3 meetings during the day, and she's working as a nurse. She's out of the house at 6:15. I'm still in bed. You know, I'm coming back from the meetings at midnight, you know, and she's asleep, and we're like ships passing in the night. I come home and have her broil something at 5 once in a while. Only thing she could do is broil. She could have anything as long as it was broiled, but that was it. I mean, that was there. So we had, you know, 2 or 3 things. And she's not pleased about how marriage is going. And we started to have kids, and I had a great mom and dad, but even great parents make a few mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the few mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made in the bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent. I'm not proud of that, but that was part of my pattern of how I was in my parenting. And I had a little gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. It was 3 or 4 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It was just kind of, but I was making about $10,000 a year playing backgammon. It was kind of like a second job, and I thought it was really kind of, you know, good deal. And these problems I had were not quarterly or semi-annually or monthly. These were daily problems. I had these problems all the time. I had all these problems in my first year of sobriety and never, almost didn't notice them. I was so almost like on a honeymoon. I was just so enthralled with my entry into AA and learning all the stuff and learning about the steps, and we're going to workhouses and doing all this different stuff. And then my second year, I started to get a sense of what my defects were. I did a 4-step in my first year, but it was not an in-depth 4-step where I really got a sense of the exact nature of my wrongs and the causes and conditions. It was kind of more removing the boulders, and I was kind of getting rid of some of the more shameful things that I had, and it wasn't until probably my second or third 4-step that I did it well enough that I was able to get at some of the causes and conditions. So I started to get handed one by one these issues that were in my life, and one by one I would take them on. Now, I don't know where I got the impression that what recovery was the absence of problems. I mean, when I was taught in my church, is that if you were a good Christian, you didn't sin. So I thought if you were a good guy, you didn't sin. I thought if you were a good member of AA, you didn't have problems. I don't know where I got that idea, but I really expected that if I got my program in line, I wouldn't have problems. You know, I don't know. I was sitting in meetings having you share your issues and problems with me. I don't know why I kind of dismissed your problems and I'm more focused on mine. My sponsor was a very realistic guy. He didn't pretend to be perfect. He was a... Warren is a very active, to this day, very active, 42-year-old member of Alcoholics, almost 43 years sober in AA. And I just admired Warren so much. I mean, he had a car that was paid for. He had a job that he'd had for 20 years. He'd been married to the same woman for 25 years. His house was paid for. I didn't think he had any problems. You know, I mean, I was in kind of in trouble in all the different categories of my life, and I'm hiding some of the pieces of that, and I'm feeling, you know, so that magnifies them, you know, and I got them right up against my eyeball. And so all of a sudden, sober in sobriety, as I start to move forward, I feel like I'm going backwards. I feel like it's getting worse. I'm discovering things that are wrong with me. I'm starting to have problems of 2 years of sobriety that I don't think a person 2 years sober is supposed to have. So I don't, you know, talk about it quite as freely as I should. And they started to bother me in my third year of sobriety. They ate my lunch in my fourth and fifth. And by the sixth and seventh year of my sobriety, I'm almost as unhappy in my seventh year of sobriety as I was when I came in as an alcoholic. And period. You know, you're at that point where you're almost thinking about suicide or talking to your sponsor. You know, you're kind of like... don't know quite what to do. You know what? I tell you. I mean, we lose our sense of powerlessness. We want our own power to run our lives. We want our information. We want our knowledge about the steps to run our life. Powerlessness is still the key. Surrender is still where the power comes from. Getting out of our own way. But you know, for some reason, I think at 3 or 4 years of sobriety, I know what the answer is. I've always known what the answer is. I get men and women who come, or men. Who come to my house and they'll sit down, they'll talk to me, and they'll talk to me about a problem. And once in a while, I'll say, "Close your eyes, you know, pretend I came to you with the same problem you just came to me with, and told you what you told me. What would you recommend I do?" Hell, they always know what to do. They just can't do it. I've always known what to do. I just didn't have the power to do it. Why do we think information? Why do we think our knowledge? Why do we think that, you know, the technology of the steps as opposed to the spiritual power of the steps is somehow going to give us that lift that all of a sudden we're going to do something? The answer is in a shift in being, not doing. You have changed the way I am, not what I do. What I do is changed because of you changed how I am. So I'm stuck in this spot of 7 years of sobriety. I'm as much pain as I've ever been in my life. And because, I've partially communicated this, because I've got a sponsor, because I'm active and I'm going to a bunch of meetings, and because I've got teachers, I know what the answer is. The people who, someone said, write down, who do you admire the most in AA? Write down 10 people. So I'd write down Bob White and Dave Cook, and didn't know Tom then, and different people. And they say, what are the characteristics? And I'm saying, well, they've got a dimension, I think, of spirituality, a connection with God on a daily basis that I don't have. I mean, it just is more workable than my relationship. I seem to be, you know, kind of like having a double life. You know, it's like, you know, Freddy Krueger arises and takes me over, and it's just kind of a, you know, sort of thing. And so I said, that's what I'd like to have. And I got a problem with that. Problem is go knock on the door. God says, who's there? I say, God is Bob. God says, what do you want? And I say, well, I want to turn myself in. I'm 7 years sober. I'm going to a lot of meetings. I'm pretty active. I'm in service. I'm doing, you know, I'm doing the deal, I think. It's just terrible. You know, God, Linda's upset with me and the kids. I'm not a good father and I'm in debt. I'm in as much debt 7 years of sobriety as I was when I mean, it's not, I'm going backwards. Now, before I forget, I want to report something to you. In one sense, I was going backwards. In another sense, I was going forward. You know, I felt like I was in the down escalator walking up. Now, the fact is, if I said to Pat, tomorrow you're going to Mexico with me. Now, before I said that, that wasn't in his mind at all. Once I said it, Pat's got to talk to his wife, got to get off work, got to get some money, buy a ticket. So the moment Pat decides to take that trip, what does he got to do? He's got to start to handle what's in his way. Okay? So as soon as I started to take the spiritual trip, as soon as I started to adapt myself to the AA way of life, as soon as I started to adapt myself to apply these principles in all my affairs, guess what I ran into? What was in my way? We talk about alcoholism as a disease. The most profound thing I learned when I came in AA, that alcoholism was physical, but also mental and spiritual. And that once we dealt with the physical part with abstinence, we used the 12 steps of the recovery program to find a different way to live that was sufficiently better so that I didn't have to use drugs or alcohol to do something for me that I was unwilling or unable to do for myself. If I didn't find another way to live, I wasn't going to make it because I didn't know how to live sober. Now, when you stop drinking, the dis-ease does not go away. Why are we active in AA? Why are we using the steps in our life? What the hell am I doing here after 30 years, almost 30 years of not having a drink? I'm here because I'm dealing with the spiritual and mental aspects of my disease that I believe is a current issue. I have a lot of moving parts, you know, kind of a complicated, sensitive, highly tuned, you know, got to have the car in the garage once in a while. We're all like Maseratis, you know, but that's why I'm active in the program today, to deal with my thinking, to deal with my spirit, to ground myself. I'm the pipe, not the well. It comes through me, not by me. The information is never enough for me. I've always known what to do, I just can't do it. So as I travel forward in my progression in the program, I was running into the unworkability of my life. Looked like I was going backwards. Going forward. This is exactly, that was what the universe was telling me to handle. We're talking like, you know, this talk is not going the way I expected it to go. But I have a new way to do four steps. I have the book's kind of complicated. It's got all those columns and, you know, Mrs. Jones and, you know, all that stuff. And it's hard. I mean, so I'm going to pretend that I'm talking to one of my sponsees who's a 35-year-old male married with children. So what I usually advise is I say you're 40 years old. Is I say get your wife. Get your mother and father, a brother, a sister, your two children, your boss, a co-worker, two members of your AA group, and a neighbor, and bring them over to the house and serve coffee. And then here's what I'd like you to say. We have a step in AA that deals with helping us find our defective character, and I'm having trouble. I'm having trouble getting in touch with mine. I wondered if you'd help me. And then pass out little tablets and then leave. And I want you to know one of the reasons it's not working. And do you know why we laugh about that? We wouldn't call that meeting. Do you know why you wouldn't call the meeting? You don't want to know. You don't want to change. I mean, if you want to know what you're dealing with, at its deepest level, one of the things that's been most surprising to me is that I don't want to change. Not only do I not want to change, I don't want to know. We will train each other. You know, you get to a certain point, you'll get AA relationships, you'll start to develop relationships with guys, we got a deal. You don't call me on my crap, I don't call you on yours. You get to a point in your life, you got me to a point of 7 years of sobriety. I was in much pain where I think I was headed back towards drinking. I might not have drunk, or I had to do something about my life. When you get that point, it's like, I don't know why it is, you can try and fail and try and fail and try and fail and try and fail at certain of the early spots in your sobriety. But there comes a time where you get enough grace and enough knowledge and you're at the right point in your sobriety and you got to change. You either change or you start to build an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. You know, the girl chasers hang out with the girl chasers, the gamblers hang out with the gamblers, you know. I mean, you know, and we have this deal. You make a deal with your wife. We aren't talking about that. You got that? Nod your head up and down if you got that. If you want to talk about that, you're not going to be pleased with the conversation. We train each other. We train our children. We train, you know, and we talk in meetings, and we talk all over like we're really in the game, 100%. My life's just an open book. You know, bull crap, our lives are an open book. We protect because the problems that we have are like solutions to previous problems. We think, like, anger was one of my biggest tools. I mean, I thought, you know, thought it worked. God. So I'm at a
at a point where I want to change my life. I'm 7 or 8 years sober, and I'm in as much discomfort as I've ever been in, and I want to go to God for help. But you know what God, the first thing God's going to ask me to do? Quit gambling. Figure that one out. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. I think he's going to ask me not to be violent with my children. I think he's going to ask me to be loving to my wife. I think he's going to ask me to go to work. I'm not positive, but I think on the list is going to be work. I just somehow know it's going to be work. And I think he's going to want me to go on time. I think he's, and the other thing, he's going to want me to stay. And I used to go out for these 2 or 3 hour AA lunches because any time, anywhere, the hand of AA reached out, I was supposed to be there. And I think he's going to ask me to straighten out my finances. Now, the problem with that is that I could do all those things, I wouldn't need God. I mean, what's the use of going to God if you can't, to develop a new relationship, if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? So I was stuck in that place for almost a year and a half. And out of desperation, I went back to the steps. I took step one, almost 8 years sober. Now, I don't think the timing is important. I was 8 years sober. I was fairly young when I got sober. For you, it might be 10. For you, it might be 12. For you, it might be 5. I will tell you only from my own experience that most people who have a fairly good-sized dose of the disease of alcoholism, sometime between 5 and 10 years of sobriety, their backside starts to fall off again. And it's almost like, I don't like this second phase recovery stuff, but I really do think I came in and I dealt with what I thought my alcoholism was. And as I started to move forward with my recovery, there was a whole bunch of other things dealing with the mental and spiritual and emotional aspects of my disease that I had to deal with, or I was either going to get drunk or not going to be a fully developed person. And I had to deal with these things, and they got to be pretty damn problematic. And this is what I was faced with. I don't think it's unusual. I think it's normal. And I took step one, and it wasn't very hard for me at 8 years of sobriety to get in touch with the unmanageability in my life. I was clearly powerless, and I was clearly unmanageable. You know what blew my mind? Step two. I'd lost step two. I could have put my hand on a lie detector, and you could have said, do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? Yes. No problem. If you would have asked me, do I believe God's going to restore Bob Bazan's sanity? The answer, baby, at 8 years of sobriety was no. Because I'm in more trouble at 8 years of sobriety. It seemed like I was in more trouble at 8 years of sobriety than I was at one. I'm going backwards. It's not working. I'm a great starter, poor finisher. I never finish anything. And here I am again, you know, the big mouth, you know, $600 suit, no underwear. You know, I mean, I am, you know, I mean, I'm right, you know. Here I am again, you know, great starter, you know, and I, you know, just where I can get the job, I just can't do the job. I interview well. Mother always said, Bob, you're not very bright, dressed well. And I've always tried to honor mother's. And, you know, will it ever get better? Will it ever get substance, you know, will it ever get better? And I had to come to believe at 8 years of sobriety that God would restore me to sanity. And I for some reason, because of the pain I was in, pain has a way. When I said before, we don't want to change. There's a guy who wrote a book, Scott Peck. I don't like talking about outside, but it's in there. He wrote a book, A Road Less Traveled, as many of you know. And then he wrote another book further along, A Road Less Traveled. And in that book, he talked about death and dying. Talk about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to the stages of death and dying. You know, when you die, you go through, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Well, so you get cancer, and you first thing is maybe I don't have it. The tests will come back. Maybe they, you know, they're going to fix it. Then you get anger. Why me? For God's sake, why am I dealing with this issue, you know? And then you get bargaining. You know, God removed this from me, and I will go to China. You know, I'll do whatever there is to do. And when you're through those three phases, when you're through the denial and the anger and the bargaining, and you're in front of it, and you can't go any place with it, you stand in front of it, you enter into depression. Now, I'm not talking now about clinical depression. I'm talking about the depression that comes from being in the presence of something painful in your life. And then he used a phrase that I had never heard someone use. He said, but if depression does its work, which from my own personal experience I took to mean if it grinds the ego to dust. You know, sometimes we hear these little catchphrases. There's an opportunity and a problem. I hate that. You know, I don't like that. But I will tell you something. How does God speak to us? Most often, I don't think we learn as much from the pleasurable times in our life. I think they're like soporific. I think we kind of go to sleep during the pleasurable times of my life. I'm zoned out. I think the problem times in my life is when the universe is speaking to me, and the message is it's not working. Now, most of us get so blind, we don't want the message. We don't see the message in the eyes of our children, or the eyes of our wife, or the letter, or in the bills, or in the whatever the hell it is. We'd like a different messenger, and we're out looking for a different answer. But the fact is that for many of us, for the different problems and defects of character, the universe is screaming at us. It's not working. That was the message. And he said, if you go through the depression, you come to acceptance. And he said that most people assume that when you die, you go through all those five phases, but you don't. For most people, the depression is so painful, they back into the denial, anger, and bargaining. They don't get through the depression. And for those of us in the room, we know that in our recovery, is that we'll go through, you know, the denial, anger, bargaining. We get in front of the problem. I really think that sometimes the power of the first step for me was the power of truth, the power of God. I think for a moment in my life, I stood naked in front of my alcoholism and saw my problems in a way that I had never seen them before. And I think standing in front of the truth about my alcoholism changed me in such a way that even though twice again I drank, it was never the same. The force and the power of seeing that truth was so strong, it just wasn't going to go away. I had to come to believe that God would restore me to sanity. I came to believe that by somehow, through the pain, being able to see you with sometimes larger problems, with a better attitude, with more dignity, walking through the issues that were in your life. And I came to believe at 8 years sober that God would restore me to sanity again. I took step three with my sponsor on my knees in his office. I had not done that before. It was kind of embarrassing, a little bit awkward, but I wanted to do it all the way this time. And I took my third four step. And I took my fifth step, and I said, when I'm done with this, I said, be careful, because whatever you recommend to me, I'm going to do. And I said, I'm in a lot of pain. And I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst, and I'm about 14 feet away from a lake. I mean, but I can't move. I mean, it's not helping. I mean, I can't get to the lake, you know. I know where it is. I know what's in it. I know, you know, how deep it is. I can't drink. I took my fifth step. And when I was done, one of the things he wanted me to do was go to a clinical psychologist or industrial, something to do with work. I had a lot of issues with work and money and success. My father was a very successful man, and he was one of my heroes. And I just thought I'd never be as successful as my old man. And I was one of these guys. I was a salesman who never made calls. And that will create a problem for you. It doesn't, you know. You even eliminate the chance that someone will grab you by the throat and force you to sell them something. So I mostly spent my time kind of phoning up reports and gambling. And I'm wondering why my company's not working. I worked for my father of as long as both of us could stand it. And and then I started my own company with a guy who was my partner, who was 33 years sober. I wasn't working for beans, and it wasn't going well. And I remember I went to this psychologist and said, could you get your parents involved? And I said, no. My parents are in their 70s. I said, they've been involved with me far too much. If you can't help me without getting my mother and father involved, find me someone who can. He said, will you get your wife involved? And I said, yeah. I didn't want to. You know, when you bring your wife to the psychologist, it's a whole different conversation when you're there alone. I mean, it's just, she has a real different outlook on a number of things. And I just thought it would complicate things. But this guy wanted her there, so hell. Yeah, I'll bring her. Will you bring your kids? I did not want my children. You know, I think they're too young. Well, I think they'd help. Okay. So now I'm going to this guy. And I got in touch with two things. He got me in touch with how afraid of failure I was. Now, if you can't fail, you can't play. I was the guy in the football team who had the uniform, rolled around the grass, got grass stains on it, did the calisthenics, did the locker room, but when they blew the whistle to block and tackle, I went up in the stands because I don't block and tackle. Thank you. And life has no stands. It's all playing field. There's no place to hide. You know, and here I am, not in the game. I'm the guy who, smart enough to get the interview, smart enough to get the job. I'm not doing the job. Good starter, poor finisher. I never finish anything. And I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm 7 years sober, and I'm feeling like I'm exiting AA. You know, I don't know if I should need to go to Gamblers Anonymous or Spenders Anonymous. I mean, I could have occupied most of my life with different clubs just dealing with the other issues in my life. I mean, I feel like I'm a failure. Sober. Active. Doing what I think I'm supposed to be doing. And what I, the other thing I got in touch with is fear. If you would have asked me what was the dominant issue, I would have said anger. Anger was my response to fear. When I got in touch with how afraid I was, that was like a whole new opening for me. And one night after, so I went to psychology, and one night in my living room, I'd been doing some non-conference approved reading one night. Well, one of the worst days I'd had. I mean, it was a bad day. I went to work late, left early, got in a game. I won $400, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, got in a fight with my wife and slapped one of the kids. 8 years sober. Would have liked to have had a videotape of that day to send it in the general service office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do. You know, just kind of the poster child for recovery. You know, just kind of. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I'm saying, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there, you dork? It's your life. And I'm saying, yeah, but it's so habitual. It's almost as if I don't make a decision to do it. It's almost like it's automatic. It's like it just kind of, you know. And then I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like a man who wanted to quit gambling. The fact was, I wanted to gamble whenever I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble with and not have problems because of gambling. I sounded like a guy, what I wanted was my wife's love without spending time with her. My children's affection without spending time with my children. I wanted to spend as much money as I wanted to spend to buy stuff and not have money problems. I wanted money without work. Now, you might imagine with that design that I had a few problems. And all of a sudden, I stood in front of the issues of my life. Almost, you see, when I came in, I gave you what I thought my alcoholism was, and I stopped the behaviors that I couldn't do sober. But I didn't give you my sex life. I didn't give you my gambling. I didn't give you my wife. I didn't give you my children. I don't know why. I didn't intentionally hold them back and say, I'm not going to do that. I just thought, you get me well from alcoholism, and I'll do the rest. I mean, I'll just live life. Now, the fact is, there's no compartments in life. And that night, out of the fear of staying the way I was, out of the fear of being a sober horse's ass or getting drunk, I got so afraid, so disgusted with myself that I got down on my knees and I took the sixth and the seventh step of the April. I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try for 7 or 8 years to get sober and to become a better man, and I had failed to some extent. And I realized that I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I was given the grace to take the sixth step, which said we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the seventh step was said we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. It happens through me, not by me. I am the pipe, not the well. A farmer doesn't grow. He creates a fertile soil, plants the seed, creates an environment where growth can take place, and God grows. A physician does not heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals, and I don't change. I create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes me. Chuck used to say so many wonderful things. One of the things he said one time at Gopher, we started a conference in Minnesota called the Gopher State Conference, and the first, you know, Chuck used to hold court, and we were at someone's apartment, and he was holding court. And he looked at me, and he said, son, you're as wonderful as you're ever going to be. And he said, I can tell by your reaction that you're kind of disappointed in that. Well, I was disappointed in that. I was kind of hoping I'd become more like him, to tell you the truth. And the other thing was I didn't understand it. I was confused and disappointed. But I understand it today. I mean, he said, the man on the street committing rape right now is doing the best he knows how to do according to his own light. What he needs is more light. The fact is, the good news is there's nothing missing. I've been active in AA for 29 years. I busted my britches to try to make changes in certain areas of my life, and I've made significant changes in some areas. And in other ways, I've not changed at all. You simply have removed pieces of failure from me and brought me more. I feel like I am more today who I have always been. You haven't brought me any place. You've helped me be more Bob. And I think that's going to be the question when the whole deal is done. God's going to, you know, he or she's going to look at us, and the exit interview is going to be, did you ever get a chance to be Bob? How were you as a lover? Were you a good lover? Did you ever get the joke? I mean, did you find out what you were doing there? Did you ever find out what your gift was? I think we're individualized expressions of God, and I think most of us have been put down here with a special gift and a special instrument to play in the orchestra. And many of us have never gotten it out of the box. And every once in a while when you're at an AA conference, you listen to a story, and the wonder of the story, and the story of Christmas, John Vicar was a man who I used to, Tom Ibister is a man I listened to. And what's the wonder of it is here's a guy who never knew he had an instrument, had never gotten it out of the box, and something happened to him one day where his ass fell off and he ended up in prison and his life changed. And as a result of the trauma, of the horrible tragedy that happened to him, one day he stood in front of that box and opened it up and found his gift and has been allowed for 40 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to play his instrument. And I'm very glad he's in my orchestra. Not my orchestra. I'm glad that we're in the orchestra of life together. And there is nothing like being in the game. And that night when I got down on my knees and I took the sixth and the seventh step, my life changed. It was like I took step one with my life, not my alcoholism. I no longer had, I can't, prior to that, I used to tell a joke about the guy who was driving down the street and he had a bread truck, kind of a panel truck, and about every block and a half he'd stop with a broom and he'd hit the side of the truck. And the guy is following behind him wondering, what in the heaven's name is this guy doing? And finally he had to stop the guy. He says, what are you doing? The guy says, you see that truck? He said, yeah. He said, it's a one-ton truck. He said, yeah. He said, I got a ton and a half of canaries in the back of that truck. I got to keep half of them in the air at all times or I can't drive the truck. And that's kind of how I felt about my life. You know, I mean, it is, you know, I had about 14 things to do, the ability to do 10, and I got 4 done. From that night on in my living room, I only had one thing to do. I couldn't always tell you what it was, but it brought a unity to my life. That night, I quit gambling that day. Such is the power of AA and the power of the sixth and the seventh step and the attitude of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. I turn the finance, you know, when you really want to make a change, I'm a guy, when I go on a diet, I usually buy a bag of cookies and a quart of ice cream. It's the last day I'm going to eat. I mean, it's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish it out and probably never have ice cream again. Which I can tell I'm talking to the right group. But I've made a lot of promises to myself that I've not been able to keep. And I don't want to pretend like I'm a guy that can snap my fingers today and make promises and manage my life, because life is not like that. But that day I was pretty serious about making change. When you're serious about making changes, you get a structure and you get help. I turned the finances over to my wife. She didn't have the problem with money and ego that I had. She could pay a third of a bill. It's the goddamnedest thing I've ever seen. And within about 2 years, she had us fiscally solvent. And I started to date my wife. I've dated my wife every Friday night for 20 years, or almost 23 years. And when I'm gone like this, we do it on a different night. And I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's love and affection I was after. I had to learn how to be with my wife, to go back and do the things that attracted to us, to each other, to have a romantic environment. And we did that. And that's been great. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I made appointments with my sponsor and with my psychologist about going to work and staying at work. And I'm telling you something. My life, it was like someone lit a rocket ship. My life took off. Everything I know, there was two things. One is I was in a business cycle that was, I was in the right, you know, someone said greed in a bull market is the definition of genius. So I was, part of it was I was in the right place at the right time. I was in the real estate investment business. But part of it was is I went back to work with my partner and started to work hard. We built up a real estate investment company that was a pretty good-sized company with 300-400 employees, and all of a sudden this guy who didn't know how to work knew how to work and, you know, was managing a couple of $100 million portfolio. For 10 years, I had the wind at my back, and everything I wanted, everything I touched turned to gold. And in truth, and then my ass fell off again. Now, in truth, I want you to know that that 10-year period was what I wanted all my life. I wanted success. I mean, I had two Mercedes. I had a big one and a little one. You know, top came off. I had a 11-bedroom house. I mean, I had, you know, all the toys. I wanted something. I just bought it, you know, wrote the check, didn't think I was hurting anybody. It was one of the crappiest periods of my life. It was, I do shallow about as well as anybody I've met. And you know how we always say, if you really want to screw yourself into the ground, give yourself your own undivided attention? I just want you to take 5 or 10 minutes and think about your body. Or your money. Or your marriage. Or your kid. You know, I mean, you know, self-centeredness. You know, where does it... And my life became about me. The Donald Trump. You know, what I wanted. My life became about what I wanted. When I wanted something, it meant that I could just go do it. Now, in some ways, I'm not against materialism. I still have the issue. It's still important to me. I still would, you know... Well, in 1986, the Junior Tax Act, and about 1990, I came as close to filing bankruptcy as you can get. I was in negotiation with 5 banks. I almost got out of it by the hair of my teeth. I lost everything I had. I had a house that was paid for. You know, I lost $8 or $9 million in 3 years. And all of a sudden, I'm back with a negative net worth, in trouble, on a budget. Think, you know, failure is staring me, you know, right up written on my eyeball. And it's 22 years of sobriety. I'm in meetings crying. You know, oh, geez, look at that old-timer over there. How would you like to have what he has? I don't know what, you know. You know, I've got our two oldest boys are recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, but this time the second one, the little craphead, came back from college and got arrested for drunken driving and totaled the car out, and we're going to the meetings at the halfway house. I start crying. The meeting starts, I start crying. I can't tell you, I mean, it's just, he's the one I'm always nose to nose with. It's just, you know, this rich amalgam of emotions and stuff. I mean, we feel like we're bad parents. I, you know, sold the big house. We're, you know, it just, it is, you know, it's not good. It's not good. And I had to find out, you know, when you get in trouble, you either get more active or less active. I got more active, and I went to the meetings. It was a tough time. I was really down and really depressed and scared and, you know, literally almost, I think, dysfunctional. I continued to give talks during that time. And you almost had to hold a gun on me. I mean, I just didn't want to do it. And I don't know exactly. Some people, when they get problems, stop giving AA talks and stop being active. I decided for whatever reason this was my place and I was going to stay active, and I did it painfully, but I did it. You're my home. You're my family. I don't have many other places to go, so I just kind of kept doing it. And I got through it. It was one of the most definitive experiences of my life. I had to find out who I was without my money. I had to get back to grassroots. I'm so damn glad that my first 8 years I didn't have success. I think I would have been a real ass. I was bad enough, you know, as it was. I mean, I thought God was blessing me because I was just such a wonderful member of AA. How would you like to be around someone with that attitude? Because when it starts to go away, then you got to figure, too, that God's taking it away because you're doing something wrong. Mostly what it was a business cycle. The other thing what it was, I remember I went to my spiritual advisor, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to become more loving and less materialistic. Within 4 months, I started to lose everything I had. That happened. I called him up. I said, we need to talk. And I did. That is a direct, exact conversation. I said, maybe you didn't hear me. I said, I want to keep the things and not be materialistic. I mean, I do not like this school of non-materialism. And we joke about that today, but I mean, that was not a joke and it was not much fun. Today, life's more normal. So I've had to learn how to be a man. I've had to learn how to be a husband. I've spent 29 of my 53 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has been a trip. It has been one of the greatest privileges of my life. I don't think I would be... I'm just so glad. I don't know where my journey would have been, but I think I would have been a real estate guy hanging out with real estate guys, and I think I would have missed I would have missed a lot of the texture and most of the depth of life. I think it might have been okay if I didn't have the disease of alcoholism. I had wonderful parents, and some of my brothers and sisters are wonderful, well-developed people. But I'm a pretty lazy guy, and I don't think I would have taken the time and energy to do the step work and do the sponsorship and do the meeting work and do the speaking and do the sorts of things that I've had to do. I've had to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to think everybody was supposed to be as active in AA as I was. I don't believe that. I believe that AA is to return you to life. AA is not supposed to be a place to hide out in and to be life itself. I think the time and activity I put in, I have been blessed for. I needed, because of whatever particular makeup I've had, I needed every bit of that activity. I see Dan Burns. Dan and I were delegates together, and, you know, I see Don Bennett, different guys in the room. I think most of us find our own, if you're open, if you're simply responsive to what you're called to do, I think you'll find your own balance. I think you need to trust the requests that end up in front of your nose. The new person, when you can't avoid it, when you're just all of a sudden in front of the new person, that's a request. To talk, to get an active in service, to have a sponsor, so once in a while you get active in request. The bad news is we have a disease that if we don't learn how to deal with it, it's going to kill us. The good news is that it's a gift, and in order to get well, you have to learn how to live. Not bad. I wish I could be here for the whole weekend. I wish I could spend more time with Tom and David and Rod and all the people that are going to be here, but I'm very pleased that I had a chance to be here and share with you tonight. Thank you very much.